Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza, the Canary's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Each week, we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days. Today, it's the value of nothing. In 2014, blogger and media law lecturer Paul Bernal wrote, "In Lady Windermere's Fan, Oscar Wilde had Lord Darlington quip that a cynic was a man who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. As with so much of what Wilde wrote or said, it's more than just a nice turn of phrase. It hits at the heart of the problems of society. Lady Windermere's Fan was written in 1892, but what Wilde wrote is even more true now than it was 122 years ago. These days, our government, our businesses, our media, and more seem to be dominated by what Wilde would have described as cynics. The idea that anyone in the real world should even consider ethical, moral, philosophical, or cultural values to be on a par with financial or economic value appears whimsical, sentimental, even romantic. Hard-nosed, sensible, rational, practical people know otherwise. It's the economy. Stupid." In today's podcast, we'll see this attitude on full display. Walking us through the stories will be the Canary's weekend editor, Tracy Keeling, and journalist, James Wright. Welcome, team.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
Oh, not bad, thank you, Tracy. Thanks for joining us today. James, your story's pretty breathtaking. Its headline reads, "The Tories distract Britain with Big Ben, then quietly sell off infrastructure we actually need." What happened?
So, Theresa May came back from holidaying in Switzerland. Very lovely holiday, I hear.
And Italy.
She got back and she wasn't particularly concerned about condemning what British-made bombs are doing in Yemen, for example.
Well, she sold the bombs.
neo-Nazis in America, and the US president, who is our, you know, one of our closest allies geopolitically, is not concerned with condemning any of these things. She immediately condemns Big Ben going silent for 4 years, which kind of shows just exactly how out of touch Theresa May is.
Yeah, it was like a classic example of that false patriotism, isn't it? That weird stuff that the right seems to do, where they're like literally cry tears over a clock not dogging for 4 years while doing what she's up to.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly that. It's kind of this superficial patriotism of flags, but then there's sort of like you look behind the flags and there's like food banks and like crying children and stuff like that, and it's kind of the opposite of patriotism, and it's just kind of another one of these things that the right has kind of hijacked over the years and tried to sort of use to divide people with identity politics and stuff like that. There's kind of this, just this focus on Big Ben, you know, it's just kind of useful for the Conservatives as well, because they don't want you thinking about these other things that they are doing and analysing these other things. And one of those things is the Green Investment Bank. And this was the focus of the article. So it was established in 2012 by Vince Cable, and it has long been criticized by people in the renewable industry and Caroline Lucas, who's now co-leader of the Green Party, who's they've said that it's just not on a big enough scale for what we actually need to do. It didn't have powers to actually borrow and lend. It just had private investment until like 2015 to 16. So,
and what was the point? What was the point of the Green Investment Bank? What did they want it to do?
So to fund some green initiatives like offshore wind and some like biofuel initiatives and just general green investment. Promote a transition to a greener economy, but it's, as I was saying, it's long been criticized as not going far enough at all. But at least it was something that they were doing that was sort of in the right direction. But then, of course, at the same time, they've got all of these tax breaks and funding for North Sea oil, and they're trying to roll out fracking when no one wants it and no one voted for it around the country, at the same time as having this Green Investment Bank. So the Green Investment Bank was just sort of a pretty thing that the Conservatives were doing, but it still did have some good concrete impact, and it became profitable in the year 2014 to 2015, and then now we're selling it off. So the Conservatives have just sold it off to this Australian bank called Macquarie. And this is a turning point, where I think the most important thing here is just the context of global warming, climate change, and how this is actually a threat to the human species as a whole. And how we really should, the Green Investment Bank should be like the main bank, the main focus of what we're doing, not a sort of side project. It should be, we're rolling out, because the coalition government was, you know, obsessed with deficits and austerity. They made it funded through private investment rather than just giving it all the power it needs to just transition to a green economy now, which creates thousands of jobs. And it's what we need to do, because the climate change that we're experiencing now is from up to about 40 years ago it was caused. So maybe less, maybe 30, maybe more. It's a very scary prospect, because for the next, you know, say we were still really embedded in a fossil fuel economy in 2000, we still are now. So in 2040, we're going to be experiencing the effects from 2000. And getting a bit anecdotal, in England, we have had the hottest, you know, the hottest year on record last year, and it's only getting hotter, and the weather is getting very strange. And I think the two are linked. And I think we do feel like frogs in the warming
boiling pot. And it's also, I mean, this is a move that's in stark contrast to the most progressive nations on Earth when it comes to, you know, green energy policy, isn't it? And we've touched on it in the podcast before, but, you know, the energy policy of the last sort of 10, 15 years in Germany, I think, is in stark contrast to what's happened here, where essentially, you know, Germany said, all right, we're going to stuff our short-term, you know, climate change targets. We're going to stick with coal. We won't go to new nuclear. But what we will do is, as these coal-fired power stations run down, we're going to rapidly greenify our energy production. And it was extraordinary, you know, that the programs that they ran out, they created nigh on 500,000 jobs. You know, rapidly decentralized energy production as well. So, you know, you've got, you know, mass rollout of solar panels on roofs, water tanks that were, you know, using rain and all this kind of stuff. I mean, literally look it up, listeners, if you want to read more about it, because it really is an incredible story. And I think either last year or this year, they actually attained, for like a day, they had basically all of their energy production was renewable.
I think, 95% or something. I'm not sure if it was just for electricity. I think it might have been for all electricity.
You know, and that's ahead of target. So that, you know, they're rapidly moving towards a state where they're not going to be reliant on either new nuclear power, which obviously has its issues in terms of, you know, danger and environmental sustainability in the longer term. We still don't have an answer in this country for where we're going to put the nuclear waste, regardless of what anyone is actually saying. And also breaking up the power of, you know, the big six that we have to deal with here. We have, you know, big six energy companies that get to effectively, you know, fix prices. Because they have effectively a monopoly.
That's why when British Gas raised the prices recently, it's like announced that the prices are going up for everyone, and that's just what's happening. Do you know what I mean? The other energy companies have already raised their prices. We're raising ours now. You can't escape. Like, that's just like what's happening. It's not it just feels incompatible with something that should be in a for-profit model.
Absolutely. So I mean, this is wrong in terms of direction, but also, James, in looking at your article, I mean, of all the companies that we were going to sell this green investment bank to, I mean, who is the, you know, who are Macquarie?
Well, I do not think that they are the ideal candidate for this bank to be sold to. Ideologically, they are just completely for profit, like hyper capitalist. Like, they've been nicknamed the Vampire Kangaroo Bank. you know, it's like if the Conservatives could have found the worst group of people to sell the Green Investment Bank to, it's probably this company.
Because it's not like they sold it to, say, an NGO like Greenpeace, who was sort of ideologically committed to the project of the Green Investment Bank, or even a bank with some sort of ethical underpinning like Triodos, you know, or a bank like that. They've sold it effectively to the Australian version of Goldman Sachs. So what's the prognosis, James? What are people, who's campaigning against this? What are they saying? Is there any chance, you know, has the ship sailed on this one now?
Well, it's been sold. The ship has sailed in that respect. But the only way we're really going to tackle the climate change problem is by voting out the Conservatives, essentially. Obviously, there are lots of other grassroots protests and movements that you can do, but we actually have an opposition right now who would, we were talking earlier about Germany, that is the energy scheme that the Labour Party under Corbyn wants to roll out, local renewable firms to challenge the big six and essentially compete against them.
Yeah.
And yeah, we need a massive renewable energy revolution that the Green Investment Bank wasn't really bringing, but it was still, you know, any progress is good, and it was still a useful thing to have, and something that could have been potentially built on in the future.
Absolutely.
As well, but now it's gone to the bloodthirsty kangaroos.
So this again is another example that's tying in with our theme of the show today, which is the value of nothing, which is, you know, they understand the price, you know, they get £2.3 billion, which is going to help them fudge the figures for this year and say that they're being successful in, you know, their austerity agenda and reducing the deficit. Never mind the fact that they've nearly trebled the national debt. Just, you know, don't discuss that. But we've lost all of the value associated with the projects that the Green Investment Bank could have run. There is no central government policy at the moment that is in any way tackling, you know, the development of renewable energy or climate change. All of that value is lost for the sake of, you know, £2.3 billion, which, you know, is just a single year benefit.
Yeah, exactly. It's a one-off inflation.
Absolutely. You know, next year they'll have to find something else to flog off to cover the shortfall. It's absolutely outrageous. So thank you for that one, James. Really, really big story. And again, if you go to our show notes, you can read more about that story in detail and find ways that you can get involved personally to turn this thing around.
Hello, I'm Nancy Mendoza, Director of Communications and Membership at The Canary. Last week, we launched a competition for you to take a photograph of yourself with your branded Canary items. We've decided to extend that, so keep on sending those in. If you're a member of The Canary, you'll have some branded items that we sent to you at the start, and we'd love to see you using those, so maybe with your mug or wearing your t-shirt, and give us a little insight into where your Canary branded stuff is showing up. So do send in your photographs via Twitter with the hashtag CanaryPod, and we'll let you know next week what we've seen.
So Tracy, some Tory ministers have been telling tales to the Daily Mail. What are they saying?
Yes, they have been telling tales to the Daily Mail, or more specifically the Mail on Sunday, because over the weekend the Mail on Sunday reported that ministers had raised concerns over Donald Trump recently to it. Obviously, there's been a few controversies surrounding Donald Trump quite recently, one being that tensions are raising between the US and North Korea based on the rhetoric that's flowing back and forward between the two, and also because there's the rise of neo-Nazis in the US. They feel quite empowered by Trump and what he says, and that there was a recent march against the toppling of a Confederate statue in Charlottesville, which ended in the death of one protester and numerous injuries of others. However, the ministers didn't want to raise concerns over either of those things, over the tensions with North Korea or the neo-Nazis march. They just fear that the trouble that's surrounding him presently is going to affect a US-UK trade deal. That was what they raised with the Mail on Sunday.
So this is driven by Brexit, the fact that, you know, Britain's going to be withdrawing from the EU. It's under pressure to make new trade deals, and basically the trade deal with America is a massive piece of that. So we're now in a situation where, while basically the entire world united to condemn not only the neo-Nazi terrorist attack that took place in Charlottesville, but also Trump's, you know, oh, they're both basically two sides of the same coin. The whole world united to condemn that attitude, that comparison, the false equivalence between, you know, civil rights protesters and literal Nazis carrying burning torches down the street, yelling out, you know, Jews will not replace us. And Britain failed to do that because of this dependency on the US, because of this trade deal. Is that right?
Yeah, that is. And it seems that it's more than a dependency just on the US, but a dependency on Trump in particular, because one of the minister's fears, seemingly, is that he might be impeached or not make it, you know, through the next election, and that a deal will have to be negotiated with somebody else. They seem very determined to have a Trump trade deal.
But doesn't that just strike you as completely bonkers? Why would anyone favour making a trade deal with Trump, who's literally gone on the record saying America first? Like,
yeah, I know. It is very bizarre. But they are even talking about trying to rush through the deal as quickly as possible prior to any trouble he might encounter in terms of his position. So they're seemingly very determined to make sure it happens with him. But you're right, it's bizarre when he is all about America first when it comes to trade. And I guess there are some other factors to the way he deals with trade and industry in general that maybe tie in with some of what the Tory government would prefer themselves. So he, of course, is get rid of all regulations. That's one of his major goals. Not all of them. In fact, when he came into office, he said, for every new regulation I add, I will scrap two.
I mean, the irony of this was already put in place as a policy by the Conservatives about health and safety regulation in Britain, and we ended up with Grenfell Tower.
Yeah, indeed. So that ties in with their ideas as well. And also, in terms of that America First policy or position, the UK government doesn't seem to mind not putting Britain first. In terms of its people and what belongs to its people, so it is ferociously selling assets through its time in government and outsourcing the services that we have. So that's giving jobs and giving profits and money to outside companies, outside...
Well, factories. Absolutely. I mean, our railways are a case in point. You have a Conservative government consistently arguing that nationalised rail services are unprofitable, uncompetitive, we shouldn't do it. And who runs our rail networks? We're paying over the odds for the state-run transport services of Germany and France to run our rail services. So these are national... We do have a nationalised rail service. It's just nationalised in Germany and France.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of getting, you know, cheaper tickets and, you know, having a more accountable rail service, we're just paying over the odds to subsidise the services of Germany and France. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. And the government is paying extra subsidies on top of it. So we
absolutely
are paying, and then the government is also paying.
I actually don't think most people appreciate that, actually, that we're still paying. I mean, when the Conservatives came to power, I know that we were still paying £6 billion a year in rail subsidies as a government. So that's taxpayer money of £6 billion a year on a private service. So you're paying once as a taxpayer. And then you've got, you know, the hideous rise every year in, you know, the inflation in the price of rail tickets. So you're paying then a second time as a consumer.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the chances are you're not going to get a seat. If you're commuting in the southeast or into a major city, chances are you're not getting a seat anyway. So, you know, you're also paying in, you know, backache.
Yeah, yeah. Paying in every way possible.
Absolutely. It's crazy. So, yeah, I mean, that backs up your point that, you know, you've got, you know, Donald Trump advocating this bizarre American first policy and almost Britain adopting quite a different one in terms of our government's position, which seems to be, I mean, we don't even know what. I mean, it's literally back to the point of the podcast. It's the price of everything and the value of nothing. Yeah. Seems to be about generating a short term profit for anyone. They don't even have to be vaguely related to the government or the public interest, and that's considered a win.
Yeah, well, it seems to be a policy of making sure private or vested interests win. So there's always a winner in these sell-offs and in this outsourcing.
Yeah.
But it's companies. It's not the people.
It's a really good point. And I think that touches on another element of your article. And I think people who are listening will probably already be thinking this. But shortly prior to the EU referendum, the trade deal, the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, was dead in the water. So campaigners, activists, environmentalists, you know, socialists, basically everyone had kind of come together, scientists, to say, look, this trade deal is damaging. It's, you know, it's anti-democratic. It's going to drag down standards across, you know, agriculture and farming, food production, science, across the board. It was seen as very, very dangerous. And we'd succeeded in basically killing it. You know, no one's discussing TTIP now. It's nowhere.
Yeah.
And ironically, on the left-wing sort of Brexit argument, TTIP was central to the left-wing Brexit argument, in that it was saying, you know, if they go ahead with TTIP, that's about, you know, that's one of the key reasons from a left-wing perspective that you'd want to leave the EU. The idea that the only justification for leaving the EU would be to sort of step away from the advancement of neoliberalism, you know, that you could actually have greater sovereignty and the ability to, you know, renationalise industry and avoid the sort of extreme hyper-capitalism that the EU is part of advancing at the moment. But that said, before the EU referendum, TTIP was dead in the water. And now, thanks to Brexit, I mean, this is just so ironic, you know, that a vote designed to, quote, take back control has basically handed over control. Because where we had killed this trade deal dead in the water, effectively, instead of now the US, you know, having to negotiate with the entire EU with not a great amount of leverage, now it's just a sort of lonely, isolated Britain against, you know, a belligerent United States.
Yeah. And also, in those negotiations, those very secret negotiations over TTIP, Britain was one of the main cheerleaders of it. So actually, it was fighting its cause in the EU.
Yeah, Germany and France were sort of pulling back a little bit and saying, hey, hang on. Yeah.
So it translates that therefore once we're just on our own doing it, those mechanisms that were in that TTIP deal and the conditions that were in there, you know, hardly that we know all of them, just leaks is what we found out about TTIP from. But what was in there, such as the investor state dispute settlement, where there's a secret court through which corporations can sue governments based on a loss of earnings because they created a policy that interferes in some way. Those sorts of things were not things that the British government essentially seemed to have problems with. You know, that the, like you mentioned, the lowering of standards in terms of food standards and the like. That didn't seem to be much of a problem for them either. So it would make sense that whatever was in TTIP or that sort of deal is what the UK government will readily agree to with the US.
Yeah, and I mean, you make a really strong point there. It's not necessarily that they're going to somehow be defeated in a negotiation. It's that they won't even be negotiating against those points anyway. Like you know, these are points that they'd already accepted in TTIP. So they're not going to be, it's not like Theresa May and her entourage are going to be out there defending, you know, the brilliant standards of food production and regulation that we've got.
Yeah, they've already, Liam Fox, the Trade Secretary, has already suggested, as has Boris Johnson, that they could be open to lowering those standards, such as bringing in pollinated chicken. So we're already starting to get discourse on it publicly.
From. Yeah, just sort of wind this one up a bit. You know, for people, it doesn't matter if you support Remain or Brexit. I think there's a real kind of ridiculous arbitrary distinction going on, as if you're too camps that are completely alienated. You know, most of us are in friendship groups that are mixed between Remain and Brexit, and we're not diametrically opposed on much. You know, there's just a slightly different interpretation of this issue, and that's fine. But I think if you are supportive of Brexit or you are supportive of Remain, I can't understand why anyone would be supportive of this. I do think actually the hard kind of Tory right are really milking this kind of Brexit Remain division to really kind of stop any kind of conversation whatsoever happening between the rest of us, who probably agree that whether we voted Remain or Brexit, you know, we don't want a bonfire of regulations. We don't want a bonfire of, you know, working people's rights. You know, this is not what most people voted for on Brexit. And I think that's probably one of the important conversations we need to have, because this trade deal is going to happen, right, Tracy? It's, you know, it's not, can't be terribly far away.
No, well, there's a seemingly an urgency for it because of the fact that at every step Trump takes, there's another problem encountered and nobody knows when an impeachment might come or whatever. So there seems to be a push to get it done as quickly as possible. That's actually been said from the very beginning. So even at the beginning of the year, Theresa May was over there, Boris Johnson was over there in the US, and each came back going, we're getting a trade deal and it's going to be quickly. So yes, it looks like it will happen. I don't imagine much of it will be happening in the public eye. So like the TTIP, it will probably be kept between the negotiating parties initially. But I don't think there's any chance of it being scuppered, apart from the fact that public pressure could have an impact. It did with TTIP.
It absolutely did.
That is what scuppered the chances of that. In large part. So I think if people come together, regardless of whether those ministers are trying to separate the camps or not, you know, allow people to see that there is a common ground here, whether you voted for Brexit or voted for Remain, people do come together and stand up against it, then potentially it could be at least catered towards what people actually want.
That's brilliant. Thanks so much, Tracy, for walking us through that one.
No problem.
So back with James. This story, oh my days. So Conservative Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt has been at it again. Someone who seemingly places very little value in transparency or the truth. But this one is really seriously taking the biscuit. James, tell us about it.
So The Guardian reported on what Stephen Hawking was going to say in a speech to the Royal Society of Medicine. And what Stephen Hawking said pretty much laid out the Conservative agenda for the NHS, what all the evidence points to, what they're doing. And what Hawking said went viral. And I think it went viral not just because Stephen Hawking said it and because it was coming from a renowned scientist, but also because of an absence of this narrative within the mainstream media. You will have some factual reporting on, say, oh, there's this instance of NHS privatization here, or maybe the very, very odd opinion piece in The Guardian or The Independent about the Conservatives' privatization of the NHS. But there's not a narrative there. There's not an editorial narrative. There's not the mainstream journalists aren't piecing together the puzzle, and the ideological destruction of the NHS is not featured, you know, in broadcast media. Especially there's not like a really BBC Newsnight discussions on the privatization of the NHS and stuff like this. So I think, but people know it's happening, you know, from we report on it quite extensively, you know, people are putting it together. There's a big, you know, online community of just people who know that this is happening. There's huge campaigns fighting it. So I think because Hawking neatly placed it all together, that's another reason why it became such a big story. That Stephen Hawking is just, you know, laying out exactly what they're doing to the NHS. And he basically specifically singled out Hunt as essentially accused him of abusing scientific evidence to talk about his what they say that they're doing for the NHS, which is to deliver a 7-day NHS, which, you know, sounds really good, sounds really lovely, because they need something to, they need some kind of target, some kind of narrative of what they are doing that's positive for the NHS to kind of obfuscate the privatization. You know, they have to be doing something. They can't just be quietly privatizing. And then when people talk about the NHS, it's like, oh, what are the Conservatives doing? What's happening? So they try and disguise the kind of destruction of the NHS within the sort of 7-day NHS buzzword. And what Stephen Hawking challenged Hunt on was the basis for this 7-day NHS buzzword, which is the weekend effect, which is that there's more mortality rates at the weekend because of staffing and stuff like that. And essentially, there's a couple of studies that show this, but Stephen Hawking is saying that Jeremy Hunt has cherry-picked these, and he has been challenged on this, and he's just ignoring everyone. And then Hunt essentially turns around and says Stephen Hawking is wrong, and takes and takes one of the studies, just does exactly what Stephen Hawking said he's doing, which is cherry picks one study, says it's comprehensive, not peer reviewed, hasn't been peer reviewed, and essentially does exactly what Stephen Hawking says he's doing. And the reason he kind of, I guess, feels like he has to is because this narrative is just something he's already gone all in on, and he can't turn back now. And, you know, he kind of has basing his NHS policies around this narrative, you know, his policies that he says to the public that he's doing. But really, they're trying to privatize the NHS and chop it up and sell it, because, you know, Hunt co-authored a book about NHS privatization in 2005. It's just one sort of sign, one of the kind of, and he's also from a family that runs private healthcare. I mean,
I mean, it's like, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. Yeah. You know, I just, you know, they get to this point where you're just like, what does it take? You know, it's one of, you know, I mean, you've touched on the frustrations about the way that the media, you know, the established media have been reporting on the NHS, and I share it, which is, you know, you've got effectively every authoritative voice within the NHS and science and medicine saying what the Conservatives are doing is with the NHS is privatising it.
Mm.
You know, this is a stealth privatisation, and there are serious costs associated with what they're doing. And we saw that, you know, even before the Conservatives, this isn't even party political. No. You know, when you had the sort of the New Labour approach, we had the mid-staffs healthcare scandal, you know, which, you know, up in Staffordshire, where you had, you know, about 1,500 people, you know, excessive deaths. Mm. You know, you had literally patients in a hospital drinking water out of vases because they were dehydrating in their beds. They were sleeping in, you know, not being taken to the toilet, defecating in their beds and being left
this is just
to sit in sheets. You know, it's just like unbelievably barbaric outcomes.
It's profit,
happen. You know,
mixing
this is not,
profit in. Yeah. It's mixing like managerial roles who are just looking at balance sheets with human lives is what it is. Like,
absolutely. I mean, when I was writing my book, I did a whole chapter on the NHS, a book about austerity and the whole process of it, and I was researching the mid-staffs healthcare scandal for that, and it rendered me speechless. You know, it's just, and I think, you know, so often, I mean, you'd have this, James, you'd have this, Tracy, you know, when we're talking to people about NHS privatisation, and the amount of times I've heard someone say, look, I don't care who provides the service as long as it's delivered and it's free at the point of use. It's like, yeah, that's fine in theory, but we've established with scandal after scandal that's not what happens when healthcare is put in the hands of private providers. Mm. So, you know, it's kind of like, oh, I don't mind walking off a cliff as long as gravity doesn't mean I go crashing into the ground.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, that's a nice statement, but it just defies reality.
I do think that presently there's still a lack of awareness that others are running the service because of the NHS logo being used everywhere regardless of who's running it. So I think there is still, and it, like you say, it's by stealth because those things mean people don't recognise as it's happening. The same with the new footprint system where the sustainability and transformation plans where they've cut the country up into 44 different areas. That in itself enables private companies to come in and take over whole little areas
and then
make it easier for, you know, for them to entirely eventually control the service.
So it's turning effectively into a franchise, isn't it? Where you've got an NHS brand like McDonald's, you know, is a brand, and then each sort of hospital or not hospital but trust, say, is then franchised out to a private provider, often piecemeal. You know, they'll do these services, then those services, and before you know it, nothing in the trust apart from the management remains as a national service. And as you say, Tracy, the other impact is you don't even have an NHS because the whole point is it's a national health service.
Yeah.
It's not a regional service. You know, a local service is that you can rely on national standards. You've got, you know, the data picked up from all over the country that you can use, you know, to deal with emerging public health risks, you know, that you maybe won't see at a local level, but when you piece together that national picture, you've, you know, got something to work with.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the profitable bits that will be privatised, and the heavy cost bits will just be left for the taxpayer as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, that was one of the theories that came out of the junior doctors dispute, wasn't it? That actually what the fear is that, you know, you'll have a lot of services that are considered elective, you know, and kind of, you know, high profit, that they'll all be going for those. And part of the reason for sort of trying to suppress junior doctor pay, increase their hours, reduce their working conditions, is essentially to kind of sex up the less profitable parts of what they do in the hopes that private providers will buy those services as well. So it's like, you know, again, price of everything, value of nothing, you know, really failing to understand the value of a public health service, which is little surprise because, as you've pointed out, James, you know, a lot of the people that are not only making these decisions, like Jeremy Hunt, but who are voting for them, you know, the MPs and the Lords, have their fingers in the pie.
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of privatised healthcare, you know, so they don't depend on it themselves because they're wealthy individuals and they have private healthcare plans. So they've got no ideological commitment to National Public Health Service. They've got no personal investment in retaining that National Health Service. Quite the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. And on the point on the they know the price of everything, value of nothing. For most of us, the price is going to be a lot more if it's privatized, because as Stephen Hawking quite rightly says, it is always gonna, if shareholders are making huge profit, it's gonna cost us more. And this is you can see this from how much the US spends proportionate to its GDP on healthcare, 17.1% in 2014, whereas the UK spent just 9.1% of its GDP on healthcare, while providing cover for everyone.
And you're right, and that gap is not like America's, you know, doing greater investment in public health. This is the profit margin, isn't it? Effectively,
essentially, that's the profit margin double, pretty much. You know, like obviously there's going to be a few other differences and stuff, but the main difference is that people are making an absolute killing off something where it's risk-free, because everyone gets old, everyone gets ill, so why wouldn't we share the risk of that? Why wouldn't we split the risk? You know, it makes no sense at whatsoever for people to profit.
And again, it comes back again to that central point, isn't it, of you know, we've discussed this with housing, we've discussed it with energy, and here we've got it with health as well, which is something that most of us would view as a utility. You know, healthcare is a utility. This government views it as an asset, something to be bought, sold, and profited from. And that difference is huge, and it is an ideological difference. And I think what I find so hypocritical about Hunt in this is that he wrote a column in the end, I can't remember, it was published now, is it The Spectator or something, where he actually calls Stephen Hawking an ideologue, like some Labour ideologue. And you're like, right... You know, and you're like, okay, yeah, right. Stephen Hawking, the physical embodiment of science, is more ideological than Jeremy Hunt, a conservative politician. All right, Jeremy, yeah. Right, so we'll wrap up here. Thank you, James, for bringing those stories to us.
You.
Lots to chew through. And again, to our listeners, do go and look up that story. It's well worth reading. There'll be a link in our show notes. And Tracy, thank you for joining us as well. And leading us through your story on Trump and the trade deal. And just before we go, I would like to say this episode this week is dedicated to the American civil rights activist Heather Heyer, who was killed in Charlottesville protesting the neo-Nazi march. And it is an absolute scandal that this isn't being considered an act of domestic terrorism. You know, one of the Nazis basically plowed his car into a group of protesters, killed 32-year-old Heather Heyer, and injured 19 other people.
You can't get like domestic terrorism.
I know. It's unbelievable. I mean, they're reporting the Barcelona equivalent as a terror attack, and yet ignoring a terror attack when it's committed by the far right. So we are recognising this as a terror attack, and we would like to dedicate today's show to the memory of Heather Heyer, who stood on the right side of history, and may she rest in peace. That's us done for another week at Canary Pod. Please make sure you follow us at Canary Pod on Twitter and use the hashtag Canary Pod to carry on the discussion. We'll see you next week. Until then, remember, don't get angry, get involved.